Simon Callow is appearing at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in a one-man show called Being Shakespeare. The play, which examines biographic details about the Bard, gives Mr. Callow an opportunity to perform some of Shakespeare's greatest scenes, playing a wide range of characters that include Puck, Hamlet's father's ghost, Falstaff, and Macbeth. Although Simon Callow has appeared extensively on stage and television in the UK, he's probably best known in this country as Gareth, the bon vivant who dies of a heart attack in the film Four Weddings and a Funeral. He's also appeared in A Room with a View and Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls, among others. It is with great pleasure that I welcome back to our show. Hello.
Lovely to see you.
How does an actor prepare each night for a performance that will include Macbeth and Lear, as well as Romeo and Juliet together?
Yep, it's quite a challenge.
That's even more confusing, I'd imagine, than doing repertory.
Yeah, what you have to do is just to warm yourself up completely in every way, mentally, physically, emotionally, and become the vessel for all this stuff. And you have to be very responsive to it in the second that it's happening. I mean, obviously that's true of any play, but with this, especially if I'm going from Romeo to Juliet, they're talking to each other, or the three characters in Midsummer Night's Dream, I just have to, you have to completely trust your ability to connect with them mentally.
But, you try to stay in character when you're performing in a play. What's the character here? Is it Shakespeare thinking about how all of these lines will be played by his actors?
No, it's just the characters. I just play the characters. I am me, the storyteller, telling the story, and then I just become those characters.
It's also an opportunity for you to play characters that are no longer age appropriate for you.
Juliet, for example.
But I've also, the actors will say, I always wanted to play Hamlet, but then for one reason or another, I never got to it. Now I'm too old.
Well, that's me. I would love to have played Hamlet, but I wasn't the kind of actor physically that anybody would want to cast in the part, sadly. Wrongly, I think, because famously about Hamlet, he is all of us.
There was a season where the Brooklyn Academy of Music, which in some ways is our most adventurous theater in New York, even though we have some pretty great theater here, they had four or five different Hamlets. They had a short, fat Hamlet. They had a very young Hamlet. They had an elderly Hamlet. They had an African-American Hamlet. And they all were wonderful.
Totally.
And they all revealed different aspects of this amazing play.
And probably there will never be an actor who can encompass all the aspects of the play. So that's a very interesting experiment.
Part of what helps pull this thing off is the staging, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's a completely integral piece of work. It's not me standing there simply speaking. The light, the sound, and the staging are absolutely integral to it. And I can't conceive of doing it without all of those elements. I couldn't just stand up and do it without that. They help to carve it up. The light holds me. It takes me from one thing to another. So, and that's how we always conceived it from the beginning. I said right at the beginning to my management, I don't just want this to be a one-man show. This must be a contribution of a sort to the art of the theatre, and that, I hope, is what we're doing.
Well, you're not credited as the writer, but I get the feeling that you participated, you collaborated in the creation of this?
It couldn't be otherwise, I don't think. Jonathan is, as you well know, Jonathan Bates is one of the leading Shakespeare scholars in the world. He's very interested in the theatre, has acted and directed plays at university. But obviously I know a great deal about the way these sort of shows work, because this isn't the first that I've done. And so we had to work and collaborate very closely. And then when the director became involved, his input was also crucial.
Now, there has been an argument over the years as to whether Americans can play Shakespeare as well as the British, because the British grow up with it. Although, as I understand it, words may have been pronounced more in the American way during Shakespeare's time.
Very much so. Very much so. I think
it... But is it training? Because American actors are much more likely to train on Tennessee Williams or Arthur Miller, and British actors start with Shakespeare?
This is quite a recent development. There was a great tradition of Shakespearean acting in this country, John Barrymore and so on. You know, great, great names, right back to the Booths, you know. But I think everything in American acting changed with the creation of the Actors Studio. And people started to distrust form. very much. And you can't even think about doing Shakespeare without acknowledging the form, the way in which it's written. And it's taken a long time, I think, for American actors to come back to the idea that just as in the lyrics of a song, you have to observe the meter and you have to observe the rhythm, the word lengths and so on. And once you do, it all comes to life in the most wonderful way.
And this play depends a lot on form, a sense of form. Yeah. There's a through line, which is Shakespeare's life and the culture he lived within.
Totally. What we're trying to do, basically, is to say, frankly, we don't know very much about Shakespeare. We know some pretty important facts. We know where he was born. We know how many children he had. We know when his plays were written, more or less. We know when he died. But we need to fill in the gaps. So what we've done is to take the famous Seven Ages of Man speech and ask of each age, what was it like to be an Elizabethan baby? What was it like to be an Elizabethan schoolboy or an Elizabethan lover? And insofar as this was the case for Elizabethans generally, then it must have been to some extent true of Shakespeare himself. And then we plug it into the plays and say, where do we find instances of this? And so, more or less, by using smoke and mirrors, we arrive at a place where I think you can have a sense of the kind of life that this man might have lived.
And the first stage is infancy. Shakespeare describes the infant mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. And you note, or the play notes, that Shakespeare invented the word puke and that the audiences of the time immediately knew what it meant.
Yeah.
Just from the sound?
I think from the
context.
Sentence, the infant mewling and puking. They must have got it. The mewling they knew. Mewling was a word that already existed. And then puke. I mean, it's all almost onomatopoeic, isn't it?
And then puke has become not the rather indelicate, but
very
a common word within the language.
We know what it means. And the same is true, of course, for many, many, many words. That
Shakespeare invented
coined.
A lot of words.
Yeah. Well, the point is the language was in a state of flux at the time. And all Elizabethan dramatists, all Elizabethan writers neologized, created phrases and words. But with Shakespeare, they stuck. You know, there are lots why many Elizabethan plays are a bit obscure is because they have coined a word and you can't even begin to think what it means.
Should we also assume that he was taking some of the slang of the time and including it in his plays?
I think he took everything. He's an all-inclusive man. He reached for anything that would make his play more vivid, and he used it.
There was a recent novel in which the main character objects to the fact that everybody agrees that Shakespeare is the greatest playwright of all time.
Well, my mother used to always say she thought that Shakespeare was a conspiracy of intellectuals against ordinary people who didn't like Shakespeare.
Oh, so it is not just people in this country who sometimes have problems understanding what's
lots
being said?
Lots of English actors have problems with Shakespeare, and they just run away from it. I've heard recently a couple of very distinguished English actors saying, no, I'm not going to touch Shakespeare. I can't do it. It just frightens me, inhibits me. It's so straightforward. It's odd that they feel that.
Well, I've always been confused by the two approaches that I've seen to Shakespeare. There's some actors that just simply speed through their dialogue, and to me it just sounds like they're just showing me that they can move their tongues very quickly. And then others might talk just as fast, and I understand every word.
Yeah. But that's surely...
Is it a matter of just trusting in the text?
Totally. And connecting to the imagery. What Shakespeare writes is so vivid that even as you're speaking it, you can't help but respond to it in some way. And in my view, a text is like a piece of film that passes through a projector. And you are the projector. You're the light. You illuminate the frame by your intelligence and by the way you speak the line. And once you do that, everything comes very clear.
My guest is Simon Callow, who's currently appearing in Being Shakespeare. It's at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And how long is this run?
It ends on Saturday, the 14th.
We have very little time.
You have very little time.
You've done quite a few one-man shows. What's the appeal for you? A lot of actors tell me that part of the fun of acting is bouncing off of someone else.
Oh, of course, that's wonderful. And I don't reject that. I love it. But I have a particular passion for storytelling, and there's nothing quite like eyeballing an audience, looking at them, absolutely getting them by the collar and saying, listen to me, listen to my story. I love that. I love the interchange with the audience. I love the way the audience changes my performance. changes sometimes even my text. I think, ah, I see. They're not absolutely understanding this, and I see why, because the narrative is flawed. Let's just try and see if we can actually communicate this idea a little bit better, and then, bingo, you've got it, and it's thrilling. And that give and take is the most exciting thing that I know of in the theatre. It's like jazz.
But you're not changing the text, are you?
Sometimes, yeah.
You are.
Oh yeah.
You're improvising on the spot.
only the text that I speak. My own, as it were, the narrator's text. Yes. If I think, I mean, I change a few words for America anyway because they mean different things. But basically, yeah. If I think, there's a better way of putting this, then I do it.
You've also done a show about Oscar Wilde, two about Dickens. I'd assume that the approach has to be adjusted because these are three very different kinds of writers.
The Oscar Wilde play is the sort of matrix. It was written and performed by a great Irish actor called Michael McLearmore, and I was his dresser about 50 years ago. I was his dresser in Belfast, and I dressed him on that show, and I fell in love with the show. He was a genius storyteller, a great, great raconteur. Many years later, I was asked to do that play, and I was frightened because I'd heard him do it, but eventually I did it, and I realised lots of people could do it, and so having had that big success, I then wanted to develop the genre and commit, you know, get other people as subjects.
Now, being a dresser, is that a typical way to get into theatre?
No, nor did it lead to me being in the theatre. I was at university. He came up to do the show. I said, I put myself forward and I said, I want to know this man. And so I did. I learned an enormous amount about him, about the theatre, about life during those few days that I was his dresser.
You've talked about how you first became aware of Shakespeare when you were sitting on your headmaster's mother's wife's lap. He was 6 years old, and you were listening to a radio performance of Macbeth. This is not exactly the sort of thing.
Well, this headmaster's mother was an unusual old creature. She was an old Cockney woman, rather hirsute, actually, and with a magnificently generous bosom. And I loved her. She taught me how to read, first of all. I was about six, and I hasten to say. And then I would listen to a radio play every Wednesday afternoon. And one afternoon it was Macbeth. Of course, I didn't understand a word of it, but I was so thrilled by the images that sprang before my eyes.
Well, if you had understood it, you probably wouldn't have slept for weeks.
When
did you see your first play by Shakespeare?
I think that was not so very much later. I was probably about nine, and I saw The Merchant of Venice.
And then there was an Olivier connection at some point, getting you into theatre?
Yeah, I'd been going to see the National Theatre at the Old Vic when Olivier ran it, with actors like Maggie Smith and Joan Plowright and Robert Stevens and Rosemary Harris, wonderful, wonderful actors. And I was utterly in love with it. I was in love with the theatre anyway, but I perceived correctly that there was something different about the National Theatre at the Old Vic, because everybody who worked in it, not just the actors, but the front-of-house staff, the box office, the ushers and all the rest of it, were also completely passionate about it. So I wrote Laurence Olivier a long, three foolscap page, closely typed letter telling him, explaining to him what a wonderful theatre he was running. And he wrote back to me and said, if you like it so much, why don't you come and work with us? There's a job in the box office. And so I got into the box office, and from that I learned everything about the theatre. And also I met young actors of the day, like Derek Jacobi and Michael Gambon. And I thought, oh, well, they're not so unlike me. Maybe I could become an actor.
But then you became a dresser. Eventually you did become an actor.
Oh, no, the dresser thing was when I was at university, because I went to university to learn how to act. And then I realized that wasn't a good idea.
Now, just one more thing, because you may even be bored by it by now, but your author here, Jonathan Bate, is a Shakespeare scholar, and I assume from this play that he believes that Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare.
Yes.
And probably was horrified by that recent film.
Not horrified, because the film is so hilarious, because if you suggest that the Earl of Oxford wrote the plays, that's one thing. But to then go on and suggest that he was the illegitimate child of Queen Elizabeth I and the father of her illegitimate child took it, shall we say, out of the realms of serious scholarship.
Well, I like what James Barry once said. I don't know if Bacon wrote the works of Shakespeare, but if he did not, he missed the opportunity of his life. It still has to be a thrill going through the canon. And not always delivering the the most famous lines.
No, not at all. I hope there are lots and lots of speeches in this play that people may never have heard or never consciously heard. But it is also true that when you start uttering the words, "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?" it's like playing the opening bars of a Chopin mazurka or some extraordinary fugue by Bach. Something thrilling catches you, and if it doesn't, then you're dead.
The thing that's fun about this production is that we really do get a sense of how Shakespeare took the things that were going on in his life and in England at the time and incorporated them into his work.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant to us now because the plays are so great on their own, but
it gives us
an insight.
It's relevant in the sense that I think it's very important to say Shakespeare was, in my view, an ordinary man who lived an ordinary life. He was plugged in to the ordinary experiences, to what it is to lose a child, to what it is to have a father who's disgraced, to what it is to have a mother who lost two children before you were born. All of that stuff, and all of the domestic stuff, which is, of course, one of the reasons we say, no, it wasn't the Earl of Oxford that wrote these plays. It was someone who lived an ordinary life. That's why we love him. He speaks for all of us.
You have until Saturday to see Simon Callow appearing in a one-man show called Being Shakespeare at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Thank you so much for coming by again.
Thank you, Leonard.